Hey, guys. How the hell are you? Oh, yeah, good, good. Yeah. I'm just going to pretend that you said good. Maybe you're holding your head and your hands crying. I don't know. If you have really pressing problems, go ahead and turn off the show and go and take care of them. But for the rest of you, you're going to have a great show today. MJ Rosenberg is going to be here to say, ha ha, to the Israel lobby. That's going to be great. Good old MJ. And then Ramzi Baroud is going to be here to talk about the status of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the current controversy there in occupied Jerusalem. And then Lauren Walker is going to get interviewed here on this show too. And you guys are going to freak, man. If you hadn't already read this, in which case, if you have, then you'll probably already freaked out about it. But, yeah. Well, there's a lot of infuriating things in it, man. That's why it's called How a Botched Translation Landed Imad Hassan in Gitmo. Man. That ain't fair. Anyway. So I read that and it made me angry, so I invited her on the show because it's pretty much what this show is about. All right, so there you go. It's libertarian foreign policy, which means I'm 100% against it. That's what the show's about. And, well, you know, it's wrong to murder people. You might have heard that somewhere before, probably, in your life, but I apply it to, well, libertarians. We apply that same moral standard to actions of governments. Isn't that insane and unique and wild and wacky and weird? So a libertarian thinks that kidnapping is kidnapping and murder is murder and theft is theft, even if the democracy voted on it? Wow. I scratch a hole right through my skull contemplating that, man. Whoa. Yeah. Speaking of kidnapping, did you see this? Did you hear about this? Check it out. The kid's name is Ahmed Mohammed. He is a ninth grader, a high school freshman in Irving, Texas, which is basically Dallas. It's like a northwestern suburb of Dallas. And the kid brought a clock to school that he made himself. A digital clock. And he showed it to his teacher, and she said, wow, that's really great. You did a good job on that. And then, perhaps anticipating that other teachers in this school are completely ridiculous and might get confused by a little brown boy with a homemade clock, advised him to keep it in his backpack. Well, later on, this is on the 14th, I believe. Later on, I think it said his English teacher saw the homemade clock and flipped out and said it looked like a bomb and took it away from him. Now, here's the thing about this. The kid goes to class and later on, he's summoned to the principal's office, or he goes to his next class, I guess, whatever. He's summoned to the principal's office, and there are the cops waiting for him. And they arrested him. They put him in handcuffs. And they took him to juvie. And somehow, somebody with, you know, an IQ over 85, with the slightest bit of discretion, at that point intervened, I guess, and in the process and called the father and had the father come and pick him up instead of at this point going forward. Although they said they're still investigating and considering which all charges to file, but he is originally charged with bringing, having a hoax bomb. That's the charge, or that was the charge, what they said. making a hoax bomb. Except that he didn't pretend it was a bomb. He didn't say, oh, look, I built a bomb. When really it was just a clock. He said it was a clock. The whole time he said it was a clock. The damn thing is nothing but a circuit board and wires. Where's the stick of dynamite, you stupid idiots? Oh, the stick of dynamite is in his brown eyes. I've heard 10 million times the lie that Islam makes good people turn bad, makes them hate and want to kill other people for being good. And so everywhere I see someone who may or may not be an Arab, who may or may not be a Muslim, I think to myself, well, government protect me before the terrorist hurts me. Even if we're talking about a 14-year-old boy. And the picture of him, you can find, I retweeted, if you look at my Twitter feed, there he is in handcuffs down at the station. He's wearing a NASA t-shirt. He's a geeky science kid who knows how to make a clock out of a circuit board. I couldn't do that. He's a bright kid. The worst act of terrorism his father ever committed was putting him in a government school. And I want to see billboards up with the English teacher's face on them. This is the single most pathetic and ridiculous person in our society. Right here. The teacher that turned him in. And the principal who called the police. And the sergeant who said, cuff them! Who are these people? How can they be allowed to get away with this at all? For 1 minute. Cowards. Underlying all of this is a cowardice. The most pathetic, slimy, contemptible aspect of human nature possible. The lowest part of humanity. On full display. I'm terrified. You're pathetic. You're hardly a human at all. Oh, but I'm white and I'm Christian and I'm terrified. Yeah, so what? That earns you nothing. In fact, that's probably worse because you have less reason to be terrified than anybody else who lives in this country. Because, of course, they're so likely to be the victim of upper middle class white panicked 911 calls and the actions of the stormtroopers on the other end of them. And what if this kid had resisted at all? What if this kid had said, no, goddammit, I have the right to make a I have the right to make a clock out of a circuit board, and you don't have the right to kidnap me for that. They'd have killed him, right? They'd have murdered him. They'd have shot him in the head and said he was a terrorist. And then everyone would say, see, terrorist tied to the Council for Islamic Relations. Because apparently his father had an association with them. Right, because, hey, if anybody needs an anti-defamation league to protect innocent people in this society, it sure as hell isn't Muslim Arabs, right? And anyway, so the young man, I was able to reach him earlier for comment.
You lousy corksuckers. You have violated my fucking rights. This Salmanambaching country was founded so that the liberties of common patriotic citizens like me could not be taken away by a bunch of fargan ice holes like yourselves. Thank you very much.
Which I thought was very well stated. And, you know, for any Muslims or Arabs or anybody else listening, you should know that it is a scientific fact that there are a lot of white Americans who are not a bunch of stupid, crying, ridiculous, crybaby, warmonger, police mongers. We're not. We hate the state. And we like minorities as much as anybody else. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there.
All right, guys. Welcome back. You know, my buddy said Poison Idea is playing. I should Google that, dude. I don't want to miss that. I still have not ever had a chance to see them. Anyway, welcome to my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hate the state, especially the wars. All right, listen, I need advertisers. I got some advertisers. I need more advertisers. See, it's a matter of multiplication. The more advertisers I have, the more money I make, the easier it is for me to continue to do this show for you. And some of you like the show and would like for it to continue to exist. And some of you in that category own businesses and or have influence at businesses. Or say, for example, you run a nonprofit group that does some human rights work or this, that, or the other thing. I'll give you a great deal, man. Let's work something out. That way I can keep doing the show. You can keep doing the thing you're doing, maybe even a little bit more productively. And, it'll be a mutually beneficial exchange, like in free market capitalism. Just email me, scott@scotthorton.org, if you want to advertise on the show. Okay? All right. Thanks. Someone mentioned to me that I have not explained Patreon well. I'm just trying to come up with more and more and different interesting ways for people to support the show. And so Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com, it's really, I guess, geared toward artists and painters and poets and things like this so that, you know, rich people can help support them in their art. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know how artistic any of this is necessarily. But, you know, maybe it's close enough. And so the way it works is people can sign up to donate per thing produced. And so instead of doing 10 or 20 or 50 bucks a month or, you know, 10 bucks a month or whatever you want to do by way of PayPal, some people have decided, well, they'll sign up for Patreon and they'll donate 2 bits or 50 cents or a dollar or so. By way of Patreon per interview. And then, you know, that's a way, I guess, to incentivize me into doing more interviews. Shut up and do some more interviews, Horton. I understand. That's cool. Well, here's how to get me to shut up and do more interviews. Sign up at patreon.com. Then I'm getting paid per the interview. And right now I have 11 patrons who have signed up to give me a grand total of $4.95 per interview. Okay, cool. Now, you see, again, the multiplication here kind of thing working on where a few more of you say, I don't know, 1% of y'all or 10 even, but just a few percentage-wise were to sign up for a few more quarters per each of you for this thing. And then maybe I do a few more interviews, and then that's an extra couple of few $100 a month to help keep the show going on. So that's patreon.com if you want to do it that way. The other thing the guy said in the email is tell people to give you money. Look at what antiwar.com does. Justin writes these things that says you have to fund us, man. Look at the war party. They got all the money in the world. And we need X amount of money and you've got to give it. So come on now. And they do it. And I just hate doing that, man. I'm just no good at it.
But it's true, and I think you guys know that. I mean, I worked for antiwar.com as a salaried employee for 6 or 7 years or something. And then the FBI, it turned out, it came out that there was an illegal FBI investigation of antiwar.com where they criminally used the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to investigate antiwar.com and specifically its donors under the pretended pretension that somehow antiwar.com, Justin and Eric, who have fully published biographies detailing their every activity since 1971 or whatever, all over the goddamn internet, as though they're this mysterious force that maybe are working for some foreign power. And when that came out, antiwar.com lost a lot of donors, and I got laid off and promoted at the same time. Well, not the same time, but short time after I got laid off, I got brought back on for a fraction of the price to be the editor of the site. I'm the editor of antiwar.com, except that I'm not the editor because I don't have a job there. I only make a little bit, which I'm not complaining about that. They're doing the best they can. But so my responsibilities, if you're donating to the show, you're not just donating to the show. You're donating to the viewpoint section at antiwar.com because I'm the one who gets all that work done. So consider it, you know, a side benefit to keep antiwar.com going as well, if you want. And just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Anyone who donates $100, you can get an audiobook or a couple different books, two different audiobooks, two different, Dead Tree books to choose from there, or a 1 ounce silver commodity disc, for anyone who donates over $100. And then, hey, be like Tom Woods. Tom Woods donates $100 a month to this show. Did you know that? In fact, Christopher Cantwell interviewed me on his show, and it turned out that the reason that he did so was because he heard Tom Woods say that Tom Woods gives me $100 a month. And he said, well, if Tom Woods is supporting this guy with money like that, then, okay, I need to stop and pay attention for a minute. And that was what got him interested in having me on his show. So I thought that was nice. So let that influence you. If you respect Tom Woods respects this work, if you like that. And I think this is the deal of a lifetime right here. Oh, deal of a century? Sorry, lifetime is redundant because it's a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. A lifetime subscription to all the audiobooks, and it's all libertarian audiobooks, all the audiobooks they've ever done or ever will do. Lifetime subscription to you. And in fact, Eric Sheriff even said, you can pass it on to your heirs. He doesn't care. Lifetime of the company, which is a labor of love that he's going to be doing for the rest of his life anyway. So long as Derek Sheriff lives, you will be getting free Listen and Think audiobooks. And if he can make it successful enough that it's a real corporation, then, and it keeps going after he dies, then you'll get, you and your people will get libertarian audiobooks forever. If you only donate $200 to the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org/donate. $200 will get you a lifetime subscription to every audiobook Listen and Think Audio has ever done or ever will do. And, so yeah. Now, I know people have said I need to come up with a hard price and do a thermometer and tell everybody I have to raise exactly this much and whatever, except there's two things about that. The first thing is, I don't really know exactly how much I need, and I don't necessarily want to be on the public record with how much I'm making. Just rest assured, it's barely anything. And then, I think you guys can all believe that. And then, what was the other thing about it I was going to say? I don't remember. Oh, yeah. I think it would be counterproductive and, in fact, maybe even embarrassing how little money I actually do make. It would make it look like a project worth, you know, a bandwagon with a broken wheel is what it'll look like if I tell you how little I'm going for and how little I'm able to raise. You know, who wants to chip in on a sinking ship kind of thing? So it's probably bad PR to do it like that. Hey, did you see Mitch Prothero's new piece? He's going to be on the show tomorrow about it. All right, three badass interviews coming up in just a sec, y'all. ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years.
and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hang on, y'all, 1 second. Sorry, my soundbite machine is broken and... Let's see if this works.
You promised you wouldn't kill me. I didn't do anything.
Don't worry. Where's the response?
Go.
What time do you want?
Dinner.
I want to kneel down.
Okay, close up.
On your knees. I want to kneel down.
Kneel down.
Man, you don't kneel down. Man, kneel down. Kneel down on the ground.
Got one
leg. Knees. Kneel down on your knees.
Lower down. Someone get away.
Take a leg.
Okay,
Penner. Yeah.
All right, legs. Mr. Skerritt.
If you can hold with the shield, man, they can lift the leg. You guys good?
Legs, Skerritt. That's not a leg.
How do you like that for filler audio, everybody? The government goons murdering Natasha McKenna there. If you haven't seen that YouTube, go to my Twitter feed, which is a treacherous place, I admit, but still, go there and page down, or just Google Natasha McKenna and look at that on YouTube. Seriously, you have to see it. You just have to see it with your own eyes. It's unreal. And I'm sorry, I didn't have any. I only had my police state section queued up for filler audio material there, and that was all I could use. I'm sorry. But yeah, anyway, I guess in a way I'm glad I had a chance to. If I can get just a few more people to take a look at that video and see the state for what it really is. You know, your fairy godmother here to take good care of you. All right. So this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I have, our friend MJ Rosenberg. He is now writing at The Nation. I can't keep track of who all you write for or when, but, MJ, I'm very happy to have you back on the show. And now this one is called AIPAC spent millions of dollars to defeat the Iran deal. Instead, it may have destroyed itself. And I thought it was unfortunate that the picture is of Netanyahu and that The Nation didn't shell out the bucks to license a picture of Nelson from The Simpsons saying, ha ha. But anyway, I guess go ahead and, let me say this about you. I know you hate it when I say this, but it's important and you say so in the piece. You used to be a very high level staffer at AIPAC.
That's right. And
you know this business very, very well. And so, it gives you, extra abilities to criticize. You understand the context a lot better than anybody else could who didn't have the experience that you have there. So I guess, first of all, let me ask you, what is AIPAC anyway, for those who aren't familiar?
Okay, well, AIPAC is, calls itself and is the, Israel lobby. It's the, or sometimes called the Jewish lobby, but more accurate is the Israel lobby. It is the only lobby that's, registered. It's not registered, but it is the only lobby on Capitol Hill for the government of Israel. The reason I have to make that correction is, it should be registered as a foreign agent, which is because it's representing the government of Israel, but it's just registered as a domestic lobby, which is ridiculous. But nonetheless, it is the it is what they call the Israel lobby. And when everyone's talking about or should be talking about who Obama was up against on the Iran nuclear deal, the simple answer is AIPAC.
All right. And so now you say that, you know, in this case, basically what you're arguing here is that they bit off more than they could chew on this one. If you had been on their side on this and still working for them,
you know, just from their point of view on this, what would you have done better to try to be more effective? I don't mean to give them advice, but I'm trying to get to the part of, well, maybe I shouldn't ask you. I just want to see, like, what is it that they did that was so stupid here, other than just opposing the perfectly good Iran deal in the first place?
Right, with that caveat that they shouldn't have been opposing it in the first place because it's good for everybody and probably Israel most of all. But let's just forget about that part and just accept the idea that they do things in really stupid ways and self-destructive ways. But if I was in charge of AIPAC, I would have told them, look, if we want to defeat this deal, let's know Netanyahu cannot come to the United States Congress to speak out against the U.S. president in the U.S. Capitol. He should not be conniving just with the Republicans, but should try to make it a bipartisan effort to sink the deal. And he should not allow Israel to become a Republican football or plaything, which it is now. So the main thing is, I think they lost at the moment Netanyahu came to the United States Congress and stood there before the House and Senate and basically gave the finger to the President of the United States. At that point, he lost.
Yeah.
They lost.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like, this is one hell of a silver lining on this whole thing. I mean, and first of all, it should be said, too, for people who, you know, maybe phased out for a minute in the last couple of weeks and missed it, they really lost. It's not just that they were unable to override the president's veto. They were unable to pass their crappy anti-deal bills in the first place, their resolutions.
They couldn't even, and look, in the Senate, they couldn't even get a vote.
Right.
I mean, you know, they had all these members of the Senate announcing in support of the bill, support of the deal. So they knew they couldn't win. But then when the Democrats said, not only that, we're going to filibuster the deal so we don't even have it come up, AIPAC couldn't even win on that. So they lost on everything. What happened was the only votes they got against the deal in Congress, it was every Republican, every single Republican, and a couple of dozen Democrats, mostly from Orthodox Jewish districts or states, like Chuck Schumer. In his mind, he's from an Orthodox Jewish state. Or sometimes he's from a Wall Street state, but he doesn't represent the state of New York.
Yeah. Well, but then, you know, I think they said that Gerald Nadler belongs to the most Jewish district in America, right?
Yeah.
And he said no to this. No to them and yes to Obama's deal.
Yeah, I think because they made it such a partisan thing, because Gerald Nadler is a Democrat who supports Obama, they turned it into a vote, you know, where if you voted against this, you were telling Obama to drop dead. And that was just too much for Nadler. Yeah. It wasn't too much for other suburban, you know, New York people, a few others, and for Carolyn Maloney, who's from the east side of Manhattan, whereas Nadler's from the west side. She went along with AIPAC, and in other words, told the president to drop dead. But it's a strange, you know, the votes, you know, it's kind of strange. Schumer announced against and everyone thought that when Schumer announced that he was against the deal, all these people would follow him. Well, at the exact same moment that Schumer announced against, Kristen Gillibrand announced for. You know, that's his, the other New York senator. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if Schumer, who is AIPAC's enforcer in the Senate, if Schumer can't deliver his junior senator, things are really changing.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, like you said, all this is because of much of this is Netanyahu's strategy of just, I'm not exactly sure why, but I guess just writing off the Democrats and saying, well, we'll just make Israel a partisan issue in America and it'll just be a Republican issue and go ahead and concede the Democrats to less Zionist factions, which at least there are less Zionist factions inside the Democratic Party. But
that doesn't seem to make much sense to do from their point of view, because, you know, the Republicans lose sometimes because people hate Republicans because they're really bad. So I'm sorry. Music's playing. We got to take this break, MJ, okay. But hold it right there. When we get back, everybody, we're going to be talking more about the politics of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. here. Check out his great piece of The Nation. AIPAC spent millions and lost on the Iran deal. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Talking with MJ Rosenberg, this time writing in The Nation. AIPAC spent millions of dollars to defeat the Iran deal. Instead, it may have destroyed itself. So where we left off, we were talking about the Republicans. Did I oversimplify it? Have the Israel lobbyists really painted themselves into the Republican Party corner here, or they still own the Democrats to a great degree? They just lost big on this one just because, for whatever reason, the president decided he really, really wanted to see this through. But what do you think? Oh, I hit the wrong button. I'm sorry, MJ. I hit the Skype button, not the phone. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. What do you understand about the Israeli government is both the prime minister, the two big players on this stuff, on this sticking it to the United States stuff, is the prime minister and the current ambassador to the United States from Israel, and the previous ambassador, all of whom were Americans. You know, that's why Netanyahu doesn't have any kind of an accent, and neither does Ron Dermer, the ambassador, or Michael Oren, the former ambassador. They all grew up in the United States, and they are Republicans. I mean, it's it's amazing. The current ambassador, Ron Dermer, was a Republican down in Florida. Those are probably the worst Republicans. And he worked for Newt Gingrich. I mean, Netanyahu grew up in both upstate New York and in Pennsylvania, and then worked in Massachusetts for a long time. But he identified as a Republican. So it's like those are the people they're comfortable with, not just on Israel issues, but on the general issues of, screwing poor people and, hating the left and all that kind of stuff. So it's a natural fit. And I think they're putting the interests of their own country behind their own personal affection and identification with the likes of Romney and Huckabee and, all these guys. It's really weird. It makes no sense because the support for Israel in terms of getting aid for Israel and all that has to be bipartisan or they're not going to get it. And second of all, they rely very heavily on American Jews to support them in their efforts in Congress and with the White House and everything. American Jews are 75% to 80% Democrats. That's how they vote, is Democratic. So this is what they're creating. Their tilt toward the Republicans is really creating not only bad, a bad situation for them, but it's splitting the American Jewish community, which is liberal and Democratic, from the Republicans and the Likud party. Mm-hmm. Crazy stuff.
Well, it kind of sounds like, in other words, what you're saying is before they had the ability to pretty well keep the Democratic Party locked on a right-wing foreign policy, and now that's what they're risking losing here.
That's it. That's exactly right.
Okay, but now, how big of a risk are they taking? Because, you know, the Iran deal is the Iran deal, and it's a huge thing, and it's clear that the Israelis and their lobbyists, their fifth column here, they did everything they could to stop it and all that. But maybe that's just the one issue. And we are talking about the Democratic Party here. I mean, how hard is it to buy?
Well, you know, I see that Obama invited Netanyahu to come to the White House in November for a hug-it-out session. I mean, I assume that's what it is. Why do you invite him for? And the Democrats are already pushing for more aid to Israel, you know, which is, you know, the Israel aid package, which is mostly, you know, it's all military aid now. We don't even provide economic aid. It's military aid, mainly used by the Israelis so they can, they can modernize their own weaponry and all that. So they're, you know, so they're, as they say, second to none in the region, but also to help them with their arms sales to every despicable dictator on the planet. And we're going to help them with all that. Who knows? That may be more important to them than Iran. I mean, the Democrats are going to try now to ingratiate themselves with Netanyahu because they don't learn any lessons and because the Democrats don't really have a soul. So.
Well, and their best guy, Sanders, is horrible on foreign policy on every issue, including Israel-Palestine, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and he's the furthest left candidate. I mean, look at the rest. I mean, he's you know, on Sanders, you know, he screamed and yelled at Vermont voters who challenged him about his support for the Gaza war a year ago.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, Democratic Party is, you know, the Republican, I don't know if I wrote this or not. I kind of forgive the Republicans on all this because they're not hypocrites at all. They hate diplomacy. They love war. The more dead people, the happier they are. Yeah,
they hate Arabs. They hate Muslims.
Exactly.
They even hate Christian Arabs for being Arabs.
Exactly. That's who they are. So for them to vote unanimously against this bill makes perfect sense with what they're all about. But for the Democrats, most of these Democrats tend to be more or less anti-war types. They certainly were against the, you know, Iraq war, lots of them. These are people who, when if they're, you know, past a certain age, they marched against Vietnam. For them, Israel is the big exception. They tend not to be militaristic except when it comes to Israel. So they're the much bigger hypocrites than the Republicans.
Well, yeah, I mean, and yeah, the civil rights angle, the domestic civil rights angle here, where these are all the people who at the very least would give lip service to the Black Lives Matter movement and all that, and they never heard of a Palestinian before, and don't you waste
Absolutely.
Their time with one either.
Exactly. If you dare make that comparison between, like, Black Lives Matter and say, well, what about the Palestinians? They'll say, how dare you make that comparison? It's an obscene comparison. It's, you know, you have to be around as long as me to appreciate how this is just this never-ending double talk and hypocrisy. I've been involved with this for like 40 years, and it just never stops. And you just nailed one of its most, you know, blatant, you know, like, you know, Jews are always active for civil rights, except when it comes to.
Saying Jews. You can say it that way if you want. I was just saying liberals in general, Jewish or not, honestly.
Oh,
just American,
okay,
the American left of center at all, you know?
You can say, I can say Jews because the fact of the matter is, not all liberals by any mean are Jews, but almost all Jews are liberals.
Right.
So, and they're also the ones who are, they've always been the most active in the left in this country. I mean, you think of, you know, going back, you know, the labor movement, in the 60s, Mark Rudd and Columbia University and Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and all those people. I mean, that's what, you know, the Jews have always been about. And then comes this big exception called Israel, which causes them all to, or large numbers of them, to like have this gigantic swerve, you know? Like,
well, but that's the news, though, right, is that that's really changing here, where American
changing.
Liberals, including Jews, have had enough of this.
Exactly. Exactly, and the polls are showing it. You know, the Pew Charitable, whatever it's called, did this big poll on attitudes towards Israel among Democrats and Republicans, and Republicans are overwhelmingly, oh, we love Israel, just what you'd expect. But Democrats are split right down the middle between being pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. That's new. That really is new. I think it's really changing. I think AIPAC's being challenged by J Street, which is a moderate organization, way too moderate for me, but it did a good job of conveying the message that not all Jews are behind Netanyahu by any means.
Right.
AIPAC is really on the ropes now. And I pointed out this thing in the article, which is their strength depends on the threats they make that if you don't support us, we will defeat you.
Right.
I know they say that because I've been in the rooms where they say that. They say, we'll direct money to your opponents. You will pay a price. Well, what are they going to do now? Are they going to try to make all Democrats pay a price? Well, they can't do that. They don't have enough money even. And if they don't do that, they're just shown to be a paper tiger.
Yeah.
If they just, if they go to these, members of Congress, like let's say Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, and say all is forgiven, it's okay, we're still not going to try to, defeat you or anything like that, then it just shows that they have no teeth.
Right.
The one thing they have is that big threat: we're going to cut off your money.
Although I guess if they picked, a few strategic targets to really unseat, then
yes,
maybe they could threaten the rest with that. But still, you're right. I mean, that would have to include people like Feinstein, who's basically unbeatable. You know what I mean?
Right.
How are they going to get rid of her? She owns Northern California.
There are so many like that. They go after Gillibrand in New York. Okay, try. Just try to go after her. And I think, the best, a really terrific thing that could happen is as an upshot of all this, is that if, like, Move On and organizations like that decide to fight against Schumer being the majority leader.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's been a little bit of that, right? Can you describe a little bit? Because there was a real reaction among, not the left, but among Democratic Party activists over Schumer's betrayal here.
Yeah, and originally, when the word went out that Harry Reid was going to retire as the majority leader, it also went out that Chuck Schumer was going to be running against Dick Durbin for the majority leader position. And Schumer did whatever Schumer does, which definitely involves money. I don't mean him bribes, but if you're on Schumer's side on anything, Wall Street helps you out and the banks and all that. Anyway, so Durbin got shut down immediately, and he conceded without even a fight, just saying, I support Schumer. But I think, so then this Iran thing comes along. It's a big deal for Schumer. Schumer is on the, he doesn't know what to do, but of course in the end he comes out against the thing. And who effectively leads the Democrats in support of their president? Dick Durbin. So what a natural for people, for liberals and for the Move On crowd and whatever other, liberals there are out there,
mm-hmm.
to say, hey, he didn't support the president. That's the job of a majority leader. If the guy in the White House is in your party, you're the majority leader, you support his program. Durbin did. Schumer didn't. He's personally obnoxious. Nobody really likes the guy.
Yeah, and all his excuses were completely hollow and stupid and were debunked by real experts immediately.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I think it's just possible. And the way it would work,
you should write a thing like that about how, hey, here's a thing for Democratic rank and file members to focus on right now. I know there's a presidential election going on, but there's some other things afoot going on here, too. And who do we want to lead the Democratic Party next year? You could have some real influence on this question, especially while the issue's hot.
It's true. I might write about that because people might think that we don't have any impact. But the way we have impact is by letting these Senate candidates, is by putting them on the spot. Like in every state that has an election, in every state or primary, are you going to support Schumer or are you going to support Durbin or whoever?
Yeah. Say, moveon.org, hell, man, that's a lot of email recipients. That's
exactly.
A huge number of people that can be mobilized, in certain circumstances anyway.
Yeah, I think I will write that.
Not
like
always
that
for good, if you ask me, but still.
Yeah, that's something really important because it's absurd to have a neocon. I didn't want to call him a neocon. Chuck Schumer, it goes wherever the money is. I mean, I don't think he cares. He loves Israel about as much as he loves the Chase Manhattan Bank. I mean, that's just who he is. He's like what was that guy's name? Willie Sutton, the bank robber. I rob banks because that's where the money is.
Yeah,
that's what Schumer's politics is like.
That's great. All right, man. Well, listen, we're over time. I kept you over into the break because I didn't want to interrupt you and stop you.
But
this is a good place to stop it. So thank you very much for coming back on the show. It's always great to talk to you.
Thanks, Sean. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's the great MJ Rosenberg. Find his article at The Nation. Oh, I have it here. It's AIPAC spent millions of dollars to defeat the Iran deal. Instead, it may have destroyed itself. And we'll be right back with Ramsey Baroud in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, how's things, man? Welcome back to the goddamn show. Well, I can't reach Ramsey Baroud. His number's going straight to voicemail. You know, I don't like that. But it is a live radio show, and so these things happen. I'm just going to have to improvise by talking about other things going on in the world. Actually, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to listen to this new spot that AJ cut for Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. And you're going to hear it, too.
I've bought silver from companies that bombard you with emails telling you that the sky is falling, buy now, and later finding that I didn't get a good deal. That's why I prefer Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. today. They've been around for over 35 years, a trusted name in the business of precious metals. So do your own research, and when you decide to buy gold and silver, get in touch with Roberts & Roberts. They like Bitcoin, too. The website is rrbi.co. That's the letter R, rbi.co.
Great. There, see, and he took my advice, too, about emphasizing the RRBI, because everybody knows what a RBI is, right? I mean, if you're an American, you know, baseball. So RRBI, that's easy to remember when you inflect it that way. Can you use inflect that way as a verb? To inflect something? Yeah. The inflection he applied. RRBI.co. Great ad. Didn't you like it, everybody? Me too. Thank you, AJ. Great job. I'm going to email him back right now. Thanks. Great job. I'm going to turn this thing right around. Well, I'm going to save it first. Then I'm going to turn it right around, and I'm going to email it off to Ian Freeman to put in rotation on the LRN feed. Oh, shit. All right, cool. It better not be rain outside. I got things to do today, man. Time zone difficulties with Ramsey Baroud. I guess we'll see what happens. Let's see, fixable? Alright. That's alright, man. Damn, no, it's not alright. I want to talk with Ramsey Baroud about the goddamn so-called holy site. I don't really believe in holy sites, but I recognize that other people do, and sometimes these things get wrapped up in controversy. So, guess we'll see. Okay. Wow, Egypt, over 400 militants killed in 9-day Sinai offensive. Wow, really? Holy crap. You know the Sinai Peninsula there? You know where the Sinai Peninsula is? Good. It's kind of not exactly Egypt proper, but it ain't South Israel either. Although, it might end up becoming the new Palestine. The Israeli Likudniks get their way and run everybody out of Gaza. Put them in the Sinai Desert, it could happen. But anyway, so I guess the way our friend Adam Morrow
reporter for Interpress Service, has explained on the show. The Egyptian government's never really had total control of Sinai, but it hadn't been that much of a problem, I guess. But then, once the Arab Spring started up, I mean, one of the things he would say is that, you know, we get very little news out of Sinai. The rest of Egypt, we don't really get to hear what's going on there. It's all sort of, you know, shrouded in mystery, but we know that there are attacks. And we know there are a lot of different groups with a lot of different reasons to fight, but we don't really know who's who or who's doing what. But we do know that we can't believe the Egyptian government when they tell us. All right. And I guess, shrug, but I'm pretty sure it's a known thing that it's a true deal, basically, that some jihadists there have gone ahead and declared their allegiance to the Islamic State. It's just like Al-Qaeda. It's just a brand name, but it works. It's not just a brand name, because with the brand, it is like a franchise. That's what they say, franchise. I didn't want to say that because that's the cliche or whatever, but it is, because it comes with the hat and the shirt and everything, right? It comes with the same menu. It's a franchise. And they go, oh yeah, here, me and my local group of guys with guns, we now declare ourselves part of this other huge thing going on. And then that opens them up to new avenues of finance, and it puts fear into their enemies too. Especially when they're claiming the Islamic State, which likes to go around butchering civilians in order to make a lasting impression on those who might consider resisting them. So, anyway, now what you have is, in 2011, the people of Egypt rose up, overthrew the American sock puppet dictator. They held free and fair elections where the Muslim Brotherhood won a bare majority in the parliament and barely won the presidency. And that was after their top three guys were arrested, or at least prevented, removed from the ticket and prevented from running. Morsi won, and he's no great leader or whatever, but he is no Ayman al-Zawahiri Islamist terrorist either. But oh well, America and Israel and Saudi and the Egyptian government ganged up and canceled the election results and overthrew Mohamed Morsi and threw him in prison. And then, just as you could have expected and predicted, as any of us could have warned, well, now you're just proving the radicals right. The conservative old Islamists have now been proven to be fools. Now it's up to, you know, the young and brash and willing to use aggressive violence to get the job done. And just confirming. And you know what? It's funny, because I would always say, you know, this is exactly like Zawahiri would have said. And then I had totally missed it. But it turned out he actually put out a podcast right after the coup, like a month later, in the summer of 2013, saying, see, I told you so. America still doing everything we can to make Al-Qaeda's point of view look legit. And so there have been terrorist attacks, some in Cairo, more in Sinai. There were Americans injured in an attack in Sinai. A lot of people said, wait, what? There are Americans in the Sinai Peninsula? That's right. It's part of a UN peacekeeping force. I forgot if it's from the Camp David Accords or from what exact deal. I guess it's left over from Camp David in the 70s. And it was part of the deal. America, or is it UN or NATO forces, maybe? I forget. I guess it's UN forces there, including American troops as peacekeepers in Sinai. And some were injured and then reinforced. Now here the Egyptians are saying over 400 militants have been killed in a 9-day offensive in Sinai. Another 320 have been arrested, they're saying. And this report is from yesterday, news.antiwar.com. The great Jason Ditz here is writing that another 55 were claimed to be killed. Operation Rite of the Martyr. Oh, good. Wonderful. You know what's fun about all this is that the 21st century did not have to be this way at all. At all. You know? In any way. That George W. Bush, man. You know, he still thinks he's right. He has every reason to, because nobody who he respects ever told him he was wrong about any of this. And he doesn't have it in him to turn on TV and say, damn, this really is because of my bad decision making, isn't it? But yeah, it is, dude. I mean, not that it's not 100% Obama's fault, too. I hate the way everybody tries so hard to see everything through a partisan lens. Isn't it obvious that Bush, Obama, Osama, Baghdadi, and Fatah al-Sisi, and Benjamin Netanyahu, they can all be 100% responsible. Sorry, I can't talk good, but I know what I'm saying. I just can't say it well. They can all be 100% responsible. It's not a quantity, it's quality. But 100% is a great way to define it, because it is all their fault. The regime change operation in Iraq, that was Benjamin Netanyahu's project, even more than it was Ariel Sharon's project. Let's read the clean break. All of this is the blood, the refugees, the chaos, the obliterated ethnic and religious factions that had existed for thousands of years. Every bit of this unnecessary. As stupid as the First World War. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Man, so Mitch Prothero is going to be on the show tomorrow, but I'm going to tell you now, you can read the article. It's at antiwar.com. By the way, if you ever get stuck at a paywall trying to look at McClatchy, if it's new and newsworthy, it'll be on antiwar.com, and you can get around the paywall by clicking through from antiwar.com, if you understand what I'm saying. We used to have a deal like that with foreignpolicy.com, but they canceled it. What a bunch of kooks, man. We could have been directing them all kinds of traffic. They do some good work there sometimes. I mean, some people do on some subjects. Anyway, Mitch Prothero, man, McClatchy, wrote an article all about how the leader of the Islamic State's military, their top military boss, was trained by American special forces. Not in the overly simplistic kind of way where, oh, all of ISIS works for America and Israel kind of thing, like some people say, but in, more of a blowback or even backdraft kind of a way. That's my phrase for more immediate and obvious consequences. Blowback is long-term consequences of secret foreign policies that people are left to, you know, unable to understand. Backdraft is more like everybody saw you do it, and these are the horrible consequences when it blew up right in your face. So in this case, Americans are trying to integrate the Georgians into NATO in order, you know, for their Cold War with Russia. And so they built up this guy, Saakashvili, who we talked about yesterday, this ridiculous kook, actually, who's now the mayor of Odessa, and they're trying to replace Yats with him to be Yatsenyuk, to be the prime minister of Ukraine now. Well, they built up Saakashvili to where he just, it's not even stupidly, he crazily decided that he would invade and conquer South Ossetia, and that the Russians would do nothing about it, or if they thought that they would, that America would come and risk a full-scale war with Russia just to help him get what he wants, a tiny little enclave as big as the county you live in, you know? And so, yeah, he bet wrong. George Bush left him high and dry. Are you kidding me? And but it turns out during that fight, guess who was the hero? See, I'm telling all Mitch's whole story for you here. The hero of the Georgian military fighting the Russians was this guy. And then one, two, skip a few. And now he is the leader of the Islamic State.
But the Georgian military trained by ours. By our special forces, in fact. And it's just another one. You know, if you like, I don't know, if you taught college or something or high school, I don't know, and you had, try to have a list on the wall of all the stupid foreign policy things that had the terrible, stupid consequences that came next, you'd never be able to do it. You spend your whole semester long going, all right, who else has one? Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Never ends. And nobody ever seems to learn the lesson. Collective security, that's the problem, man. All of it starts from premise one. Wherever America is not providing the security, there is not security. Well, that's insane. And as you can tell, it's national suicide. I mean, it's mostly a murder plot against foreigners, but it ends in a mess here too, you know. Kind of a thing. You could tell. They don't even really pretend we have a rule of law anymore. The rule of law is government can do what it wants. America, where at least I know the government is free. But that's it. Anyway, I'm sorry, man. I should be moving on. Doing a better job covering the news. You know, I'd rather just repeat myself from yesterday about the West ignored Russia's offer in 2012 to have Assad step aside. A serious offer, as reported here in The Guardian, and well reported, it seems like. A serious offer. The Russians were going to go ahead and step in and accomplish the regime change. And the West completely refused to cooperate whatsoever. They'd rather have a war. We call the Easterners barbarians, man, but you take a close look at American society and ultimately you have to admit, man, ultimately it's how, quote unquote, we let our government act. And I know you and me don't consent in it. I'm an individualist too, but Americans in general don't seem to have a problem with this kind of thing very much. Bunch of Syrians dying. And that might be a good excuse to start a war, but it's never a good excuse to not start one. A good reason to not start one, somehow. All right. And then here's another thing that I meant to get to on the show yesterday that I didn't get a chance to get to, and that is diplomats confirm, of course, the IAEA inspectors will be present for sample taking at the Parchin site. And the story is a Reuters scoop debunking the Associated Press. Oh, wow. George John at the Associated Press reported a thing about Iran's nuclear program that turned out not to be true. I know you're confused now. You're thinking, wait, am I listening to a rerun from 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14? Something like that earlier this year, maybe? No, this is live right now. September the 16th, live on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm referring to the most recent case of George John, who is, I would surmise, not actually a journalist at all, but an Israeli spy pretending to be a journalist whose one and only job is making up or passing along ridiculous, nonsensical, even, stories about Iran's nuclear program, right? Like charts where if he asked any nuclear expert in the world, they would say, that is not a representation of a nuke going off there, pal. And then he publishes it anyway, you know? He doesn't check. Doesn't want to. But anyway, just think of how much this worked. How many conservatives forwarded an email, millions, tens of millions of American conservatives in the last month have breathlessly forwarded emails about how that Muslim terrorist usurper of John McCain's rightful throne, Obama, made a deal where Iran gets to inspect themselves. Nope, you're all just a bunch of rape victims. That's all you are, conservatives. Only is it really rape when you drop your pants and bend right over and let liars lie to you? It's
It's kind of like a date rape in a way, because you just can't seem to get it that they're lying to you. Hey, newsflash, they're lying to you, you stupid idiots. Do you really think? Did you take one moment to investigate to see whether that's how IAEA inspects nuclear facilities or suspected ones? Nope, you let liars screw you right in your brain ass, right where you deserve it. So good. But you're wrong again. You're humiliated again. You stupid idiot conservatives, you.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Whew. By the skin of my teeth, man. All right. Welcome back to the show, guys. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. Full archives at scotthorton.org, of course. Our next guest on the show today is Lauren Walker, and she wrote this incredibly important piece. We ran it in the news the other day on antiwar.com. I hope that you saw it. How a botched translation landed Imad Hassan in Gitmo. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Lauren?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Great piece of journalism you've put together for us. So tell us, who is Imad Hassan and how did he end up in Guantanamo Bay?
Well, it's a very complicated story how he wound up in Guantanamo Bay, as you read. But Imad Hassan is just one of the many people who filled the prison. His story is remarkable and it's not remarkable at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. It's not remarkable just because it's been repeated so many times and by people to his left and right and all around him in that same place. But yeah, taken as an individual story, I'm glad you told it this way. You know, here's this one guy, and you could, of course, like we're saying, multiply the same story over and over again. But when you make it this way, it almost seems like he's a human being. Like, there, but for the grace of God goes me, myself, kind of a deal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, now he was, it is kind of complicated, and you could see how they made their mistake in the first place, right? Because he was, I think you report in here, if I got it right, he was arrested in conjunction with the same sweep of arrests by the CIA and the Pakistani National Police that landed them Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and, you know, related terrorist targets. No?
No, Abu Zubaydah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Zubaydah. Okay. So. Yeah. They thought at the time high-level terrorist targets. Same, exactly. Or almost same group of sweeps there, but different period of time. Sorry. Okay, but anyway, Zubaydah, who they thought was Al-Qaeda's number three, whatever. So this guy was arrested in a house that had some association with Zubaydah, who, of course, did have some association with Al-Qaeda, correct?
Right. I believe that the piece that they had was they had been in electronic contact, meaning likely a phone call between a house that Zubaydah was in and this house.
And that was it. That was the only connection that they knew of, or thought they knew of, at least, between these two houses.
Well, they also had an anonymous tip from a foreign government. A tip from a foreign government saying one of their informants implicated it as a safe house. Mm-hmm.
But then you say that, well, he was there, you know, as a student, and all kinds of people were coming and going through that house. So if Osama's right. best friend had been there, that didn't necessarily implicate anyone else in the house.
Yes, his lawyers tell me that before he even went to Pakistan, he had arranged to stay at this house. And when he got there, he didn't know some of the other people who were there. I mean, it was a large house. There was around 15 people. So, yeah, it could have been anyone. Didn't necessarily mean he was associated with them.
Yeah. And, you know, I hate to say this because I don't mean to, you know, make light of the situation, but only in a kind of contrast sort of way. You could see what happened to this kid being like a Saturday Night Live skit, right? Where his, you know, Al-Qaeda, Yemen. This young kid says, hi, okay, mom and dad, I'm going off to Pakistan for my religious training and whatever. I'm going to go learn to go to school or whatever it was. And then later on, there he is admitting to the Americans under duress that, yes, I'm associated with Al-Qaeda. When all he meant was, that's his hometown, really?
Yeah, I really grappled with that because, I mean, it's funny and it's tragic at the same time.
It's completely ridiculous. And you could see, again, you could see why they made the mistake. But then I guess you don't seem to leave much doubt in here that the American authorities have understood for a very long time, maybe even before they got him to Guantanamo, but certainly for many years now, more than a decade, they have known that this guy really was not a terrorist. Really, they don't have any other reason to believe that he was associated with the group Al-Qaeda at all. And they understand the careless mistake that that's actually a town in Yemen.
Right. I mean, something that has been repeated, also Kiriakou told me this, was that their policy was if you were Arab and you had no passport, which he did, Ahmad Hassan did, but if you were Arab and they didn't know who you were being arrested. And many of those people who were sent to Gitmo, they didn't have much information on. And yes, he was cleared in 2009, but there are many hurdles to getting prisoners out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they must have known. They had interrogated him plenty. They knew long before 2009. That's just when the reviews, the Obama-era reviews were instituted. But
right,
I'm sure if we had all the paperwork, we'd see that they knew, you know, back in the era of Rumsfeld and all that, just how innocent he was. And now, let me ask you as a devil's advocate thing, and maybe that's just his cheesy excuse, that that's just the name of his town, and maybe he really is a terrorist. Is there any other real reason to believe that he is, that maybe I'm overlooking for confirmation bias's sake or whatever?
I mean, if you look through the paperwork that was released through WikiLeaks, there are little bits like his plane ticket was bought in conjunction with another person who they suspected. But at the end of the day, if there was all of this evidence against him, they should try him.
All right. And now, so then the other thing is, I'm not sure, I'd need a real expert, and maybe you know all of the different reasons that have been invoked by the military, by the White House and others for who gets released and when. But obviously the big one is, if you're from Yemen, you can't go, because we have a terror war against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Well,
right.
We're fighting for them and against them at the same time now. But anyway, under the rubric of fighting against them, Obama can't take the political risk of a Yemeni from Guantanamo going home and joining up with AQAP. So they have to stay.
Right. There have been a few blocks on sending people from Yemen out. And then in terms of other reasons why one person leaves versus another, there's been very little transparency on that. But countries do come in and do interviews, and there is a whole long process for getting countries to agree to take detainees. So there are many factors, I think, that we're not even aware of as to why one leaves and one doesn't. I mean, his lawyers speculated that maybe his disciplinary infractions while he was at Gitmo contributed, such as leading hunger strikes or being part of a hunger strike, things like that.
All right. And now, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry because I probably implied that he's still there, but that is kind of the big news here is they did eventually let him go. They made a deal to send him to Oman. But how many more Yemenis are still there just because they're Yemenis? Do you know?
I don't know the exact number, but it's a large chunk are from Yemen.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like Kiriakou, you're quoting Kiriakou, the CIA officer who was involved in that raid on Zubaydah, et cetera, saying that basically any quote-unquote Arab Afghan were to be considered Al-Qaeda and nabbed. That's it. If you're an Arab, what the hell are you doing here?
Mm-hmm.
And that was enough. And never mind all the, you know, Afghan
sheep herders and whoever that got rounded up just, you know, because somebody got paid to point a finger at them. But certainly basically any Arab that they could get was enough. You know, well, and really, from the beginning, it was a public relations stunt to make it look like there were armies of these guys. When back then, Al-Qaeda was no more than a couple of hundred guys, and most of them had been killed by the CIA and the Air Force in the early or the late part of 2001 there. So they had to try to make it look like there was an actual enemy. So they just rounded up as many people as they could. There used to be 750-something people there. Mm-hmm. And it was Bush who let more than 500, I think maybe even more than 600 of them go. Because even under his lawyers, they had to admit that, you know, these people are just too innocent to hold. We got to let them go.
Right. And something that was interesting that one of Ahmad's lawyers told me was that the countries that had political pull were getting their detainees from their country out faster. And some of his clients were telling him that they were even scared of some of the people that were leaving.
All right. Now, boy, that just says a lot right there, doesn't it? Just like, you know, murderers getting out of prison while people on pot charges rot. We'll be right back with Lauren Walker in just a second, y'all. Newsweek.com. Hey, y'all, check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm talking with Lauren Walker. She's a reporter writing at Newsweek.com. This one is called How a Botched Translation Landed Ahmad Hassan in Gitmo. And you got to read it. It's just one of those mind-blowing sort of squeegee your third eye kind of a deals, man. Get you living right in the real world. All right, so... there's so much stuff I want to ask you here, Lauren. I guess, first of all, for this segment, was he tortured at all, or can you describe what you know of the worst of the treatment that he ever suffered?
Sure. So he has been, or he was on consistent hunger strike from 2007 on. And because of that, it provoked the guards and medical staff to force feed him. And so that is considered to be torture by groups like the Red Cross. And his lawyers estimate that that happened to him over 5,000 times. So he's developed...
Since 2007, you said, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's developed some chronic issues from that. He has chronic pancreatitis. One of his nostrils is swelled shut. I mean, he weighs less than 90 pounds. So... that's something that he definitely dealt with. He's been beaten. It's something that he doesn't really like talking about. So his lawyers haven't prodded him. But if you read Guantanamo Diary, those are some of the things that many have had to deal with.
Yeah. But so no indication that he was beaten within an inch of his life by the military holding him in Afghanistan or put through all this stress position routines and experiments under Rumsfeld down there and that stuff.
No, he was held in stress positions. I know that. Yeah. I know he got the facial slap.
Okay. So, yeah, they put him through. But do we know whether that was CIA or military that was doing that to him?
It's military. He wasn't in CIA custody.
Oh, they never did again. Okay. Yeah. All right. So yeah, that's an important point to stop and make there. And then, so now as far as the hunger strike, from 2007, it seems like, he would be in terrible shape. I mean, even if they're forcing Ensure down his throat, it seems like his health would be severely compromised. Do you have long-term effects from that or anything? Do you know?
Yeah. So he has the chronic pancreatitis.
Oh, sorry. You did say the pancreatitis. Yeah.
His one of his nostrils is swelled shut. I mean, he's sent letters to his lawyers describing the ways that his force feeding regimen has changed. I mean, Guantanamo has a turnover of staff, and he describes in his letters, explaining that he can't have too much in shore because he'll throw it up, but because he's a detainee, he isn't listened to, and so they do it anyway. And when he throws up, sometimes it's protocol to start the process all over again. So there's a lot.
Yeah. And now, I guess the counter argument is, well, he's trying to starve himself to death, and they can't let that happen, so they have to.
Right, and that's the position of the government, is that this is a last resort to help with issues such as malnutrition. His lawyers have told me, and he's told them, that he didn't want to die, but this is the one thing that he had control over.
Right. Under 90 pounds, you say here. Under 90 pounds. Mm-hmm. And yeah, of course, I mean, and the whole deal with a hunger strike, of course, is, you know, like you say, he's not trying to starve himself to death. He's trying to get us to stop him from having to. That's the point. And, you know, it's the most pathetic cry for help that you could possibly have. Like,
and
that's
it. It has proven to work. I believe in 2013, there was a mass hunger strike that caught President Obama's attention. So, yeah, they have reason to believe it will catch someone's attention.
Well, in catching Obama's attention there, it certainly caught public attention, but you're saying that prompted Obama to make some changes?
Yeah, I believe that he reaffirmed his commitments in 2013 because of it, to closing the facility, to releasing detainees, but yeah. We see where we are with that.
Yeah. And now, you know, it's funny, too, I knew I was going to forget his name, but Clive Stafford Smith, who you quote in here, is one of his lawyers. He's also representing this guy who is the last Brit in Guantanamo, who Obama publicly promised David Cameron, the prime minister, that, yeah, I'm going to send this guy home. He's clear for release. He's going to go, and he's still not home. Do you know what is going on with that? Because I think Clive wrote a thing basically saying that, well, the military is just insubordinate. They're refusing to follow his order, apparently, here.
Right. There have definitely been reports about there's internal disagreement about sending him specifically and others out. I mean, there's a million reasons why he might not be out that we don't know about. But I've heard that there's worry about his condition and being sent out and people seeing. That was definitely something that was brought up in Ahmad's case by his lawyers. They thought maybe that could be a reason he hadn't been released yet. I mean, we really don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they got to get him to sign a confidentiality agreement like they did David Hicks. I promise not to describe all the ways you tortured me as long as you just let me go. You know?
That was an interesting part of the data that the Director of National Intelligence releases. There was a report out by Seton Hall saying that they speculated that some of those recidivism numbers included people who have come and spoken out about their detainment.
Oh, really? That just that this is a terrorist act against America, as if when they're released, they talk to the media.
Exactly.
Isn't that something? You know, I always just dismiss those numbers of the recidivism thing. I really should have looked into that. What a great point. I want to check into that more.
I'll send you a link.
Yeah. Oh, would you please? Yeah, that's great. Yes. And isn't that always a way? That sounds like, you know, I'm shocked but not surprised kind of a thing, you know?
Right.
What do you think, audience? You like that? That's what it means. Oh, look at all the, you can't let anyone out of Guantanamo or they'll be recidivists. Yeah, by telling the local media, here's what they did to me. Amazing. The same thing that they claimed when the three mysteriously died at Camp No back in 2006. They said these three guys committed suicide, and it was an act of asymmetric warfare against the United States, trying to make us look bad by dying on our watch. What a terrorist act. And, of course, Hickman, who you quote in here, and the other Scott Horton, they've, and Seton Hall, in their studies have shown, you know, just how not very mysterious those deaths are. They weren't suicides at all. But I guess that's a different story. But an important one. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so now that this guy is quote unquote free, I don't know exactly what his situation is in Oman. Is he talking to anyone? Were you able to talk with people who represent him now?
Or him, so the, or him the at all? Closest I got to speaking with him is speaking to the person leading his resettlement with Reprieve.
Mm-hmm.
Reprieve is the organization that is representing him. The lawyers come from his lawyers come from Reprieve.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was talking to her, and it's very fascinating, all of the considerations that they have to make. I mean, these people have huge gaps on their resume. They have no connection to the place that they're being resettled. In some cases, there have to be language classes, et cetera. But she was very clear that the biggest hurdle he will face is stigma, because while he has been released, he was never charged, which means he was never cleared.
Right.
So, yeah, he's going to have to face that in his new country.
Yeah, everyone is going to just assume that he's a rat, or else what's he doing out?
Yeah, something.
Yeah, something bad. Yeah, or, you know, just take the story at face value, he's some kind of terrorist, but more likely they'll think it's suspicious that he's free then, you know?
Right. And I mean, there's little information really about each of these people. I think that this is rare that such a in-depth look at just one of the many occurs. And I mean, hopefully people read it, but it doesn't have that type of spread, this article.
Yeah, no, but you know what? It does make a difference. It's chipping away. It's certainly, for historical reasons and everything else, it's helping to, and in real time, helping to provide a better context and understanding for the true situation down there. It's very important work. I really appreciate your doing it and your time on the show today, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, y'all, that's Lauren Walker, reader at Newsweek, how a botched translation landed Imad Hassan in Gitmo.